everyone. Welcome back to CoronaCast. I hope you're doing well. I'm Tilly and I'm here with my mum.
Hi, I'm Hannah. Welcome back.
And we have another episode for you.
First, my disclaimer. So I'm a GP and I'm not an infectious diseases or public health expert. So opinions expressed are my own and not on behalf of an organisation.
Just wanted to say thank you to everyone who's listened to our last episode and shown your support once again. It's much appreciated. Just to flag, we said in our last episode that our next one would be about mental health, but that one is taking quite a while to get together. Longer than we expected because we've got quite a lot of contributors, but look out for it because it's set up to be a very exciting episode. So in today's episode,
yes, today we have an interview with my friend Ben, who I was at medical school with. He's now a doctor in intensive care in a hospital just outside London. So it's going to be really useful and interesting to hear how things are for him right now.
Yeah, but before we go to that, we have another question for you from one of our listeners, Andrea, who's currently in Bulgaria. And it looks like her boyfriend has been suffering potential symptoms of corona, so they've been self-isolating. And she wants to know whether if you get the virus, does that mean you become immune to it?
Thanks for the question, Andrea. Now, this is a difficult question to answer because, as we know, coronavirus disease has only been around since December. So the disease is relatively poorly understood and we're learning different things about it all the time. And what we do know is that it behaves pretty unpredictably.
Yeah.
People seem to sometimes test positive and then they test negative and then they test positive again later. So the behaviour, like I say, isn't totally understood, but infectious diseases experts seem to say that it's unlikely that you would get the infection again. There have been some cases reported where people test positive and test negative and then they have symptoms later on and test positive again. So it looks like you may be able to in rare cases, but mostly once you've had it once, you'll be immune. And if you do get it again, it's thought that you would get a milder version of the illness.
Okay.
So that's also quite a reassuring thing to hear, I think.
Yeah, cool. I hope that was helpful.
And now, please do send in your questions.
Yep.
We love to hear from you.
Questions at coronacast.co.uk.
Yep. And now on to the interview with Dr. Ben Ford.
Hello, Hannah.
Nice to have you on the show. Thanks for doing this.
Pleasure.
Obviously, we're in quite a crucial week in terms of the coronavirus in the UK. And it's going to be really interesting for our listeners to hear what it really is like on the front line. And as we're hearing, it's the A&Es and the intensive care units that are going to be really, really overwhelmed initially anyway. But, you know, as will whole hospitals in the end.
Sure.
How has it been for you?
So we've seen a fairly big increase in the number of patients who have this new COVID-19 infection coming to the intensive care unit. And yeah. I guess from my own personal experience, particularly in the last, I've just come off of a set of nights, so I've been on night duty in the intensive care unit. We're definitely seeing an increase in the number of patients that are very unwell and needing more kind of sort of intensive treatment, including things like being put on to ventilators over the last week. But it's been a kind of steady increase. I wouldn't say that at the moment we're kind of, you know, we're not overwhelmed. We haven't had like a kind of tidal wave of patients coming through quite yet.
Just out of interest, what happens when someone comes in with COVID-19? Like, is it very obvious that they have it or, what happens?
Yeah, so it's a very good question. So from my point of view, I don't get to sort of discuss them or see them unless they've kind of come through to they've come through to A&E. Say for instance they're unwell, they've seen their GP, the GP's a bit worried about them, they send them to A&E, and then they go to A&E and then the doctors and A&E are worried about them, or they refer them to the medical doctors and then they're worried about them. So basically, in order to...
They go through quite a few people. You see the people who are really, really sick.
I see the people who don't see the mild cases. No, so I don't see the mild cases. And so out of the people that I see who are very unwell, that there's quite a lot of consistency about the kind of history of what's happened before they've come into hospital. And they normally have had a kind of dry cough, often not particularly severe, for about a week, with possibly with fevers and people having to, you know, temperatures over the course of that time. And then suddenly they feel more unwell. And that seems to be, you know, the patients that I see are the sickest of the sick.
So
when they come into hospital, they say that often they've been able to manage with it and everything's been fine for about a week or so, or 5 days. And then suddenly they started to feel much, much worse, and they started to feel a bit breathless.
So you feel like you're about to sort of get this sharp increase in the number of patients. Would you say that in Hertfordshire you're slightly behind the London centres, where we're hearing, you know, they're really rapidly filling up?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I think London appears to be, understandably, the kind of epicentre of this pandemic in the UK. I mean, it has to be, doesn't it? I mean, there's so many people moving around, the public transport system, the way in which, I mean, I used to live in London. I think by the very nature of the fact that people are rubbing up against each other so frequently in London, and I think the density exactly. And I think that although once we started to see cases in the UK emerging that were tested positive, we have to really understand that before those cases were tested positive, there was likely to be a significant number of people that were positive, and that the kind of behind the scenes, lots of people have been rubbing up against each other, infecting each other, and that we always knew that the cases that we were seeing was really kind of the tip of the iceberg. Whereas in where I am, it's outside of London, although there is a significant number of cases, and actually we're in one of the kind of higher density of cases in the UK outside of London. But there isn't an enormous amount of testing that's going on for patients who are kind of have moderate disease or are unwell or have followed the government's guidelines of saying, you know, one of my family members has got a cough, or I've got a cough and a fever, and so the whole household is self-isolating. Those patients aren't getting tested. So the number of cases that we're seeing is more a kind of reflection of the number of patients who are quite unwell and actually coming into hospital.
So do you think the government should increase its testing?
Yes, I think I can answer that very straightforwardly. I think yes, absolutely. I think obviously it's difficult because testing everybody, or testing as many people as possible, is a very resource intense thing to do. However, I would say that I think that has to be a focus on trying to broaden the testing as much as possible, because by doing that, by testing as many people as possible, we'll get a much better understanding as to what the baseline level of infection is within the population, a better understanding as to how many people are infected who are actually relatively asymptomatic. And I think that's really important for several reasons. And one of the reasons that I think that it's important for the control of this virus is that to be able to get the public to understand that the measures that are putting in place, just because you feel okay and you don't have a fever or a cough, but say, for instance, one of your members of your household has got a cough or a fever, just because you feel okay doesn't mean that you don't have the infection. And I think that being able to get a better clarity about how many people are actually infected will give us a much better understanding about the spread of the virus, much better understanding and about the progression of the virus, and also just give the public a better kind of better view of the reality of
Who's got it and who hasn't, exactly. And who might be spreading it.
Yeah.
Because that seems vague right now anyway.
And so just going back then to why social distancing is important, as you touched on, we have this asymptomatic spread, don't we? So people don't know they've got it.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a spectrum. So this, what makes this infection, this virus particularly complicated is that rather than it being similar to you know, a very severe infection like Ebola, for instance, where if you get the infection, you get very, very unwell, and the large majority of people who get the infection, they die. This is absolutely almost the opposite end of the spectrum. So what is happening with this infection is that there's a large, the majority of people that get this infection do not get a serious infection. So about 80% of people that get this infection will get a very mild infection. And out of that 80%, some of those people will get no symptoms at all or very, very mild symptoms, but they will still have the virus replicating in their bodies and they will still potentially be infective. And then there's the small minority, the 20%, who will get it seriously enough to need to go to hospital. And then there's a smaller minority of those that become very seriously unwell that I end up having to deal with from an intensive care point of view.
Yeah.
And so from
So that's why this virus, in a way, that's what makes it so... such a clever one.
Yes,
like, because with a virus like Ebola, where people get very sick and when they're infectious, they're so ill that they can't lead their normal lives, or they die, then the virus isn't spreading. But when
that's
it's
right.
one like this, where 80% of people who've got it are happily going around their daily life, that's why it becomes so widespread.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not a public health specialist, but I think that when you've got an infection which is so severe that it's easy to see the symptoms, and that a large majority of people get extremely sick and or die, the contact tracing. So basically, what that means is being able to find out who that person has been around or with is much, much more straightforward. If patients are symptomatic, it's very easy to isolate them and bring them into a unit to give them the proper treatment they need, and then basically you can contain the spread. But the problem with this virus is the COVID-19 virus is that actually the majority of people don't have a very serious infection, and I guess particularly, I mean, I've got two young children, and I think most of us who have got young kids in the house, for instance, would find it fairly normal that they are coughing and have got runny noses for most of winter, and that we might as parents have coughs and to runny noses but not feel terribly rough for you know, intermittently throughout winter. And so
it's
difficult to differentiate that from, for instance, this new infection. And I think that a lot of people understandably have kind of felt, well, I don't feel any different to how I would do normally, and my kids are no different.
Flu or a little...
Absolutely.
A little bit of a bug.
And
yeah,
exactly. I've got a bit of a bug, and so I'll crack on, go into work, and, you know,
soldier
or maybe
on.
I'll soldier on, maybe wait and see what's going to happen and see how it kind of unfolds. But I think the danger is that even if it's mild or it doesn't really kind of come to much in yourself, by going out and interacting with other people, the consequences are quite significant because...
Yeah. And they're not significant for those people, but it's the people that they have contact with who are more at risk, either being elderly or having other health problems, comorbidities, as we say in medicine, that make them more susceptible to getting the disease severely.
Absolutely, Hannah. And I think that's the crux of it, really, is that what we see particularly in this virus is that it is more when people who are older get it more severely. So what I mean by that is that the majority of elderly people that get the virus will be okay, and they'll have a relatively mild infection and they won't need to go into hospital. They won't need to have any kind of very significant treatment. Generally, however, the small minority of the sort of patients or people who have got coexisting medical problems, like, for instance, things like diabetes or high blood pressure, or are elderly who gets unwell, they can become extremely unwell. And I think that what we're seeing is that that even though the majority of people don't have a serious illness, because of the way in which this virus is spreading so rapidly, and it's such a it's running through the population so quickly, is that that small proportion of people who get it really badly, when they get it really badly, it is a very, very nasty infection, and can mean that that patients need to have support for their breathing. They need to be put on machines to help their breathing, to wait for the infection to die down and settle down. And some of them get extremely unwell. And obviously, as we know from the information coming out of Italy and China particularly, you know, the significant proportion of people do actually die from this infection. So even though you might have a mild symptoms or no symptoms at all, but someone in your household has got a cough, it is absolutely imperative that you reduce the amount of people that you have contact with, because there's no way other than you having been tested for whether or not you have COVID, you do not know. And the more people you have contact with, and the more people that you you potentially could infect, the consequences are quite significant. Because if you, for instance, spread it to somebody else, and they spread it to somebody else, and they spread it to somebody else, and then down the line you have an elderly person who's got some other medical problems, they potentially could become extremely unwell from that, even though they're trying to do their best to remain isolated. So I think the guidance to try to keep as isolated as possible, reduce physical contact with people, social distancing, trying not to kiss each other, touching elbows rather than shaking hands, not gathering in crowded spaces is absolutely imperative to try to slow the spread of this infection.
Important. Yeah, it's incredible. The London parks have even had to close, because although people were being allowed to go outside to exercise, again, because of the density of the population in London, parks were packed at the weekend because of the nice weather.
I mean, if I was running, I wouldn't like to run with anyone else anyway. So, you know, I think people just, you know, they need to run on their own. You know, they need to try to not, don't run in groups, run on your own. That's, you know, be a loner. That's
be a loner like Ben.
yeah exactly.
Yeah, it's also just like easier if you know it's not like if you have a symptom, have symptoms but don't feel that bad, or someone in your household does, you self-isolating for those 2 weeks could really stop this spread. And like, that's not too much to ask for such a big thing, I think.
No, absolutely. I'm a great believer in taking one's own advice, and ultimately, you know, my partner has gone up to stay with her mum, with my two young kids, and I'm on my own. I would much rather they were around me. We've taken our two children who are 2 and 1 out of a sort of communal childminder. And all these things, primarily not because of our children. I think it's more to do with my partner's mum, who's, you know, nearly 70, although she's very healthy. And I also don't want to get unwell, because I want to continue to be able to work and continue
a very important job.
Yeah. And initially, when this all happened, my main concern was that I was going to potentially be at a higher risk of contracting COVID from work. And then my eldest son has got some health problems, and my main concern was that I was going to bring it home and potentially give it to him. And then as the data's kind of unfolded, it seems to be that children are actually very able to deal with this infection. And there's, from the data from Italy was quite outstanding, is that, that basically there was no deaths in any children under 10. That may have changed since I read that information, but it was quite outstanding that children seem to be particularly able to deal with this infection. So my
which is very interesting, isn't it, because flu usually affect the very young and the very old, but here it's,
absolutely
it's just the very old and the young just got away with it.
As with all viruses, but particularly the flu is very similar, is that the virus is genetically quite fragile. So as it spreads, it is also evolving. So as much as we can rely on data from what's happened in China and Italy, as time passes, it's possible that there is basically, there will be subpopulations of this virus. It's not necessarily, what we're dealing with is the COVID-19 virus, but it is possible that there will be subpopulations of that virus that are actually very different and either will be very much milder or potentially could be more severe. And as time unfolds,
I've heard mixed views about that, about whether it can change in such a quick time. Possibly not, but you know, I don't think we can rule anything out with this virus at the moment, can we?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think what we need to do is we need to continue to follow the research that is ongoing, and there is an enormous amount of research that is happening at the moment to try to find out, understand more about the virus, but also to try to find possible treatments for it to potentially help with those that are the most sick, but also trying to get a vaccine ultimately to prevent people from becoming unwell.
And that kind of brings me on to another question that I was going to ask you, which we've had from a couple of people who've got in touch with CoronaCast. Antonio from London and Karen from London. They both were asking about treatments. Saying, you know, they understand that a vaccine can take 12 to 18 months to develop minimum. But what about treatments that are coming through? Surely we've got some experience now from Italy, China and elsewhere with some possible treatments that we can give our patients.
Yeah, so there have been a few medicines that have been sort of targeted as sort of putative treatments to help with the virus. I mean, we have to understand that it's much like most viruses, that there aren't specific treatments for a lot of viruses, and so the main sort of treatment is actually just to let the body deal with the infection, and there are things that we can do to help that. So, but there have been some medicines that have been identified that potentially might help clear the infection faster or help particularly with those that are significantly unwell. Some of them are the medicines that have already been licensed for the use in treatment of HIV. And initially those medicines looks like they, from some of the early studies that in studies on the virus outside of sort of humans in the lab, look like they might be good medicines to help treat this infection. However, the most recent studies have shown that those medicines haven't really been the magic bullet that everyone was hoping for. The other medicine that's got a lot of press is hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, which is a medicine that's normally used to treat malaria, but also is used to treat some forms of inflammatory arthritis.
Like rheumatoid arthritis.
Exactly.
Those patients are on hydroxychloroquine, aren't they?
That's right. So and so it's got a long history, it's got a good safety profile, and there is some emerging evidence that it's possibly may be helpful in those that are severely affected with this illness. It may help. However, I think the key thing really to say is that in order to get a better understanding about which medicines are effective and those that are not effective, that these medicines need to be really trialed in proper clinical trials, so proper studies where they can compare them to sort of placebo, which basically means comparing them to standard treatment to see whether or not there is a real genuine benefit.
Yeah.
And without doing that, the problem is that people may start using these medicines, which do have side effects and that do potentially have that may not be effective. So the general consensus is that there are a few targets that have been the focus of the scientific community, and we need to continue to watch what the studies show.
Yeah, I suppose if I was a layperson, hearing you say this and say we need to do trials, I would be thinking, look, we know this disease is really severe. We've got these possible treatments. Why not just give them a go and try? Because we, you know, we're desperate to help people survive here.
So it's not that we won't give them a go, but it's the way in which we give them a go that's important. So by giving them a go and doing it in a proper scientific way, not only can we help people, but we can actually get a scientific understanding as to whether or not they're effective. Because the last thing we want to do is to give lots of people a drug that is actually not effective for the treatment of this disease. And as I said,
we need to prove it,
and that's exactly. Exactly, and that's exactly what's happened with the HIV retrovirals, which initially they thought were potentially a very good medicine for this, and then now the studies seem to show that they're actually not very effective. So, yeah.
Interesting. I guess, yeah, in the same way as we want the testing to be scientific to inform us more and more about the disease, we also want trials of tests to be carried out scientifically
for treatment.
Yeah, that's the best way to do these things. Tilda, do you have any other questions for Ben?
Also, with the, like you were saying, it's interesting seeing the media coverage. Would you say, like, what are the main differences between the reality that you're experiencing and what you're seeing being reported?
It's tricky. I mean, there are serious concerns about the availability of personal protective equipment, so the PPE that people are talking about, which enables the staff members to protect themselves from an infection. That is a serious concern, and we have been experiencing shortages of sort of essential equipment that we would need to protect ourselves. That's definitely the case. And we're certainly seeing an increase in numbers of cases on a day-by-day basis. It feels like we're starting to get a better understanding of the disease and the particular people that seem to require more intensive treatment and who require what we could describe as organ support, so people being needing to go onto ventilators. So we're certainly starting to see the kind of people that seem to do worse, I guess, when they get sick. But also we're getting better at dealing with it, so that's the positive, I guess. The whole time that this is unfolding is we've had the last few weeks, we've had time to try to get better at dealing with this and dealing with the problems that will emerge in the next few weeks. Now, and you know, we are working extremely hard to try to do the best for our patients. So,
yeah. Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Take care. All the best.
Okay.
Bye.
You too. Bye.
Thank you so much to Ben again for doing that interview. I found it really interesting to hear what it's like on the hospital front line from someone who is literally dealing with sick patients with coronavirus, because I think for a lot of people it still feels quite far away in a way.
That made it feel a lot closer, didn't it? And a lot more of a possibility.
Yeah, it did.
Thank you, Ben. He had a lot of interesting things to say, so I hope you find it useful.
Now, time for our positive news or thought of the day. So my one is actually a piece of news today, and it's something I saw on my friend's Instagram story a couple of days ago, that carbon emissions in the UK are the lowest they've been since 1998. And I just liked that, because I think with this virus, things feel scary, things feel negative, and I feel like knowing that it's having some positive impact on climate change, which has been a really prevalent thing over the last year.
And also a real worry to people, well,
living on this planet.
Especially younger people, more your age.
The future. So, it was nice to see that something positive is happening in amidst all this scariness.
Yeah. And my positive thought was just that I've been really enjoying the sunny weather and the days being a bit longer. And although the current situation with coronavirus is very anxiety inducing for everybody, at least hopefully a bit more light,
a bit more sunlight
will help
always
people,
goes a
lift
long way,
people's spirits a little bit.
Yeah, that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, and please do send in your questions to questions@coronacast.co.uk. Also, comments and feedback welcome. It's good to hear what you want to hear.
Yeah.
You can also follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @thecoronacast. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.